Hello, everyone, and welcome to broadcast number 68 of Indie Radio.
Indie Radio is an indie game development talk show that airs bi-weekly on Saturdays at noon U.S. Central Time to help you keep up with the ever-evolving world of indie game development, debate about issues in the indie game scene, and to let you into the mind of some of the most interesting people behind the creation of indie games. Today, I'll be your host, Brett Hudson, broadcasting from the Midwest United States. And we have a guest today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, hello, I am E. McNeil. I am an indie game designer from San Diego. I've made some virtual reality games called Darknet and Tactera.
We met E. at Indiecade. It was already 2 weeks ago. Jeez, time flies by quickly. And I actually had to get my hands on Darknet and play it for the first time. And it is so cool. Like, I don't even know what to say. It's so different than all the other VR games out there, in the sense that it's like this kind of fantasy virtual, you know, hacking game, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I usually tell people it's like Hollywood's idea of what hacking was in the 80s and 90s, and you're inhabiting that in virtual reality.
Perfect. So, we're gonna do our news as always first. There isn't a whole lot today. And then also, if you are listening to this live, there's an IRC channel. You can either check it out in your IRC client of choice. It is at the afternet.org network. The channel is just Indie Function, I-N-D-I-E Function. Or if you're listening to it on the Indie Function radio page, you can scroll to the bottom of the page. There's an iframe there. Just type in a username, hit enter, and you'll be in there. And you can chat with both of us. You can suggest news topics. You can ask E questions. Just go crazy. So the first thing in the news is the Handmade Con, which is super cool. So Casey Muratori is running this convention called Handmade Con, and it is based off of the Handmade Hero series. And he has a list of five amazing people coming to talk throughout the day. So it's, I believe it's 8 hours. It's on December 5th, which is a Saturday? Yeah, it is a Saturday because it overlaps our show, actually. And he has Tommy Refinis from Super Meat Boy, Mike Acton, Pat Wyatt, Jonathan Blow, and Ron Gilbert joining them, which is a fantastic lineup, and they're going to each be talking for about an hour and a half and be talking about different things in games programming. Like, with Tommy, Casey really wants to find out about creating fluid controls, and then if you want to go with, let's see here, yeah, Mike Acton, Casey's going to ask questions about managing teams, scaling code, and maintaining a code base that isn't complete chaos, because he's the engine director at Insomniac Games, so he knows all about that stuff. And Casey, he's just lovely to listen to, so regardless, this is going to be a fantastic convention. Tickets are on sale right now. They just bumped up to $45 on Thursday. But you can still pick them up, and then it happens out in Seattle, by the way. So if you're in that area on the 5th, definitely consider checking this out, because it's going to be great. There is no information if he's going to be streaming it, whether we're talking like Twitch or just an audio thing like this. So we don't know if it'll be available online, initially or ever. So definitely jump on that if you want to check that out. Have you heard about that, E?
I hadn't, but that sounds like a really good guest list. Anything with Jonathan Blow.
Yeah, much. Right?
Yeah, but Insomniac, Casey Muratori, Tommy Refinis, there's really good names there.
Yeah, I'm guessing then perhaps you've heard of the Handmade Hero thing that Casey's doing?
I have definitely heard of it, but I can't recall what it is right now.
Yeah, so I might as well bring it up. Mm-hmm. It is him streaming once a day, Monday through Friday, on creating a game completely from scratch using C++.
Right, I do remember this now.
Yeah, so he goes in, like, just week two, you're, like, writing your own pixel buffer and sound buffer using C++, so there's no using libraries or, like, frameworks or anything. It's all just, hey, we're going to jump in and we're going to make everything and we're going to say that we made it all. And it's a great learning opportunity for anybody that wants to get into games or anybody that's been doing games for a long time and wants to learn more about low-level programming. Casey goes on these tangents all the time that, like, they're never boring, and you always learn so much. Like, one time he went into, like, how the CPU works and, like, all the little caches. It's so interesting. And now I'm going on a bit of a tangent. our last show was during IndieCade, so I suppose we should also recap what happened at IndieCade. And I've already forgotten which games won the awards, so I gotta pull that up quick. Where is it?
I remember some of them.
Yeah, because here we go. I think this is it. Award games? Yeah. All right. But which ones are... See, I should have grabbed this link earlier. Here we go. Okay. So, there were a handful of awards this year. More than previous years, if I'm correct. The Media Choice Award... I was super pumped to have helped towards Codex Bash winning that. That was a cool hardware-based game. I believe that was right next to you, wasn't it?
Yeah, I played a lot of it.
Yeah, that was created by Alistair Aitchinson, who I actually have known for quite a few years. We haven't chatted in probably 4 years, but we ran into each other, and we were talking to IndieCade. He's like, oh, yeah, you should come check out my game. And then I looked at his name tag, and I was like, oh, my gosh, you're Alistair. So that was fantastic. Developer's Choice Award went to Rose Macbeth, which... is that one of the games? Or is that the developer?
That was, I think, one of the night games. Ah. So it was only played on, I think, Saturday night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I was going to say, I don't remember seeing that anywhere. Okay, if it was a night game, then yeah, that makes sense. I wasn't there for the whole night games. I kind of just jumped in and just hung out with people, didn't really participate. Mm-hmm. what else is there? Oh yeah, the Grand Jury Award went to Her Story, which I still haven't played, beyond a couple minutes at IndieCade. So... should probably get on that if it won the award. And then what else is there? There's some smaller awards like Story World Design went to Donut County, which is just so much fun to look at. It's such a quirky little game. And then Memory of a Broken Dimension, that game is mind-boggling. Did you get to play that, E?
No, I got to watch people play it a little bit, but and it looks gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I haven't gotten to play it myself.
Yeah, so the way that it works is that it uses virtual reality with an Oculus Rift, and then it also tracks your hands. And your left hand allows you to reach into the past, and your right hand allows you to reach into the future. And you have to solve puzzles using this weird time manipulation ability. Just so weird. The Audience Choice Award went to Bad Blood, which I thought was pretty interesting, because that was one of the physical games, if I'm remembering it correctly. Wait, no. Let me look at which game this is. Oh, no. This was a cool one, though. This was in the eSports tent, so it was only there for a little bit. But yeah, that's really cool that it won the Audience Choice Award.
Yeah.
IndieCade happened and awards were given. Tons of great games. We did do write-ups on some of the cool games that we found on each day on our website. So you can check those out as well and find out about all sorts of cool stuff.
And the number one game listed on the first day is Darknet.
It sure is. First game on there. All right. What else happened in news? I didn't see too much. I mean, there were a few things that happened, but they weren't really worth mentioning. Like, what was it? It was something Monkey shut down. It's a software that allows you to turn your phone into a controller for certain games. Wish I could remember what it is. I deleted the email. But yeah, that was kind of sad to see that go. It was in games like Race the Sun. It allowed you could use touch screen or tilt controls on your phone and use it on your laptop, but they're not running anymore. So yeah, I'm gonna go check the IRC. All right, bit quiet in there today. But if you are just listening in, and you want to join us in the IRC, it is at the bottom of the Indie Function radio page, so indiefunction.com/radio. I'm sure if you're listening to it, you're probably listening to it there. So scroll down, type in a username, and you can join us, ask us questions, all sorts of stuff, because we're about to jump into the interview to talk to E about Darknet, virtual reality, his new game, Tactura. I'm saying that correctly, right?
I say Tactura, but I'm not going to really go correcting people, I think.
Oh, okay. Tactura. Okay. That definitely makes sense. But pronunciation. Yeah, there's another game recently that every other person said differently. I can't remember what it is.
Naming's the hardest part of game development.
Yep. All right. So, let's talk about Darknet. You want to give the fame story of how you came up with, or how you were inspired to create Darknet?
Yeah. So I actually had the idea of Darknet for a long while. You know, as soon as the Oculus Rift was announced and I started sort of daydreaming about what kind of game I might want to make in VR, a hacking game was kind of an obvious idea, because in part, like, I had this association of, like, putting on the virtual reality headset and, like, going inside the computer, which I think is borrowed from sort of, you know, a Hollywood trope of, you know, movies like Johnny Mnemonic or Hackers or The Matrix or things like that. So I backed the Oculus Rift Kickstarter, got one of the early development kits, and then Oculus ran a contest. They called it the VR Jam, in collaboration with IndieCade, actually, back in 2013. And it was like a three-week jam to make a game for the Oculus Rift. And I made my hacking game. And it wasn't called Darknet at the time, but it was essentially the precursor to Darknet. And that ended up winning the jam. And so I got to go to IndieCade and show off the game at the Oculus tent. I got to visit the Oculus headquarters and talk to their developer relations people and everything. And that was what gave me the push to turn it into a full game. And then, at that time, nobody really knew how to do anything in VR. So if you had shipped anything, you were considered a VR guy. You're like an expert relative to most other developers. And so I started being pegged as, you know, a person doing VR stuff, and decided to roll with that and keep making VR games with my next one. And so, you know, I had a bunch of ideas. I tried out a few of them, and Tactura became the next project. But we can talk about that later.
Oh, that was the end.
Yeah, sorry, abrupt.
No, it's okay. It happens on the radio. It's just like, oh, that was the end of the story. So that you got to go to Oculus headquarters. What was that like?
It was pretty cool. They were a lot smaller back then. They had a headquarters in Irvine, California, and since then they've moved up to the Bay Area, to Menlo Park. So, yeah, I got to go inside and shake hands with Palmer Luckey and, you know, look at, you know, he was actually testing out some of the technology that eventually became the Development Kit 2, and I got to try that early, which was really nice. I got to try out some games and talk to the people, you know, who were making stuff happen, which was all really cool. I don't want to oversell it, though, because they're actually really, like, accessible and pretty good about getting in contact with developers. You know, there's some co-founders of the company who just are walking around mingling with developers like me, you know, like studios of size of one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not usually like, they don't really put up big walls between themselves and developers. But I got to experience that, you know, pretty early on.
Yeah, I wouldn't imagine that they would want to put up a wall, because VR could potentially be a really small niche, you know, kind of following. So making sure that they can get in as many developers' hands as possible is definitely a good thing. So did you get to see the Samsung Gear before everybody else, or...?
Yes, I did. Yeah. So I stayed in contact with the Oculus folks, and then later at GDC of the next year, I was offered to do, you know, to meet with them, and I wasn't told anything about it. But essentially, they, you know, showed me the, you know, earliest version of a Gear VR. There was a lot of stuff that wasn't working. It wasn't quite as good or high resolution, you know, or comfortable as the final version. But enough was working that you could see, you know, that this it proved the concept. You know, you could get good VR working on a phone. And so Darknet was being built for PC, but it was also, like, one of the reasons that I wanted to do that game is because it was pretty abstract graphics, pretty stylized, you know, something that I can do pretty simply without being able to build detailed art myself. And so that also makes it a pretty good candidate for porting to mobile. So I... you know, got down to it and started porting Darknet to Android. Got it running on a phone, which is pretty difficult for VR stuff. And yeah, it worked. So Darknet actually launched its full version in December of last year.
Okay.
But that was for the Gear VR Innovator Edition launch. And their sort of real consumer launch is happening this year. So it feels like Darknet is sort of half released at this point.
Yeah, you did a really good job with getting it to run on the phone, because I didn't even realize until the end, like, completely realized that there was the Samsung phone running the game. Like, I was really impressed with how smooth it was.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure if that's mostly your doing, or if, like, the Samsung stuff is just really... really well made. It's probably a combination
of both. Like, you probably couldn't do that on just any phone, or one, you know, a phone where they hadn't sort of unlocked some of the special stuff that they unlocked for Oculus. Like, they have a deal with Samsung where, you know, there are certain things in the Android operating system that no one's allowed to touch unless you're doing VR, and that allows the phone to run faster and potentially overheat and things like that. So, you know, I'm making use of all of that, but I also, you know, put in a lot of work, and I'll claim some credit for that.
Yeah, when is the consumer release? Is that happening right now, or is it happening?
It is happening this month. They haven't announced just a particular date, but they've pretty much said before or on Black Friday.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, and so that's if you have any of the latest Samsung phones, anything released in the last year, then... you'll be able to get good VR, you know, by buying this $99 headset.
Yeah, that's really inexpensive compared to some of the other headsets. I mean, I think that's like the cost of a Leap Motion, isn't it?
Yeah, it's close to that. I think it might end up being really popular. I don't know if it's as obvious a choice if, like, you don't already have that phone, but there's so many people who have... you know, these are really popular phones.
Yeah.
Millions and millions of people already have them. And if you happen to be one of those people, I think it's kind of a no-brainer. You know, if you have any interest in VR, it's a really, really good way to get into it.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about some crazy computer setup. You don't have to configure anything, yeah, really. It's just plug in and go.
Ease of use-wise, it's better than PC. It's, you know, you're just not going to be able to get the same kind of detail of graphics and things like that that you'll be able to get on PC.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be one of the only downsides. But you can bring it anywhere. You can even bring it to parties. Oh, that'd be fantastic. Because, like, whenever I think of VR, I think of all these cords running everywhere hooked up to your PC and you having, like, a 5-foot radius of walking around. Yeah. My roommate had an Oculus dev kit while I was in college, so like that's kind of my experience with VR.
Right. It is really nice for showing to other people, because you know you don't have to bring them into your VR lair. You can just sort of hand them something and tell them to put it on. And I actually just a couple days ago I went up to a event in LA to demo some of my games. And I have two Gear VRs, different versions, and just threw those in like a little messenger bag, and that's all I had to carry. Whereas normally you're carrying like the giant case for the Oculus Rift and like a PC that's powerful enough to run it, and then all the associated cables, and you know it's a big hassle, at least for an indie.
For anyone.
Yeah.
You gotta like bring a little cart to push it all around in.
Yeah, it's always an adventure setting up for like packs or something like that where you're doing a lot of demo stations. Gear VR is great in comparison.
Sweet. Let's see. Samsung Gear VR. I'm gonna drop a link in the IRC. All right. Oh, and that would not be the right spot. And
there we go.
Also save that for afterwards. Samsung Gear VR. It's coming out this month. Oh. Now I kind of wish that I didn't get a new Motorola phone.
Yeah, I mean, I don't use the Samsung phone as like my just standard phone. I'm lucky enough that I got some for testing purposes and for development purposes from Oculus. So, you know,
yeah,
that is kind of a barrier.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, I could take an extra phone.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be the worst thing.
Yeah, and that's what Samsung, like, I think also a lot of people, it might be something that determines what kind of phone they get. If they're on the fence about getting the Samsung Galaxy S6 or, you know, the whatever competing Android phone,
mm-hmm.
This might tip the balance, and that's what Samsung wants. You know, I think from their perspective, they're probably not thinking that this is going to like really push the bottom line at all for them, because you know their business is gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
But it is something that you know they can sort of point to. That's like, look how high tech we are. Look at the things that our phone can do that no one else can do. You know,
absolutely.
So, It's a nice alliance between Oculus and Samsung and developers like me.
So a couple times I've tried explaining like Darknet to people. Like just the other day, Ian, who's usually on here as a co-host, he's like, "Oh man, this looks pretty cool, but what exactly do you do?"
Yeah,
it's like, well, there's this grid, and you kind of like place these viruses on the blue nodes.
This has been my challenge for like the entire time I've been developing it. Yeah, it's so I usually, you know, describe the game as a cyberpunk hacking game, and the astute gamers will ask, "Yeah, but what do you actually do?" Which is entirely the correct question, but just way more difficult to answer because the gameplay is so abstract. So my best attempt at answering it, you know, without using visual aids is that Darknet is like a strategy puzzle game. You have a network that you know is presented to you that's composed of hundreds of nodes, which are like these little spheres. Every single one of them represents like a server you can hack. So you can enter any of those nodes, and you're presented with a puzzle. And if you solve that puzzle, you get money. You can use that money to sort of upgrade your abilities so that you can solve more difficult puzzles. And you're therefore sort of working your way up through these levels of difficulty, hacking harder and harder servers, going through more and more security. and your goal is to be able to hack the most secure server in the network within a time limit. So you're sort of racing the clock.
That is a great description.
It glosses over the "and then you solve the puzzle" part, which is like a whole other layer to the game. And then there's also all sorts of, you know, sort of special software that you can purchase that sort of can weaken the network or can capture things without you having to hack servers manually. But, you know, it's the game does a better job of explaining and presenting that than I could over radio. So there on the website, if you go to the demo section of the website, there's a video there that's sort of my attempt of, like, you know, playing through the game and narrating it to explain in 10 minutes, like, here's what the game is, how it works, what it looks like.
Sweet. Yeah, was like trying to start two separate sentences there. Didn't work. I actually ended up sending Ian to your site and just saying, hey, watch this video. It'll explain it way better than I did. But yeah, no, that was a great description. I'm gonna have to steal that and be like, yeah, so
I've been giving that description, you know, in different ways on in shows and stuff like that for a couple of years now. And I still not, you know, 100% satisfied with it. It's just really difficult to describe this game, as you said, because it's like, well, there's a bunch of hexes and they sort of spread out and they collide with each other. You know, it doesn't lend itself to words, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, elevator pitches are just hard too, because it's like, where, how do I go into enough detail without going too in detail while also accurately describing what I want?
Or also, like, I actually think the coolest part, or the part of Darknet that I'm most proud of, mm-hmm. is the mechanics of how the puzzles work, because it's like a mechanic that I've never seen it before. As far as I know, it is new. It is, you know, its own unique thing. But beyond that, it has like all sorts of cool properties where, like, you know, it can expand to sort of be any size, you know, and expand in complexity, or it can, you know, be tweaked in difficulty in a lot of different ways pretty easily. And it's randomly generated, so every puzzle is different. That's not all, you know, that's all not easy to do. And it all produces pretty good gameplay. Like, it's pretty interesting to think your way around these puzzles. At least in my humble, unbiased opinion. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I will agree with you. It was a lot of fun. I think my favorite thing mm-hmm. was one of the viruses, the one that spreads throughout the adjacent nodes.
Right, yeah.
When I placed that, like, I saw it happen, and then it started spreading super, like, in wrapping the screen and watching mm-hmm. that, like, as it goes throughout all the different servers, and, like, being able to turn my head and watch it, oh, that was probably, like, the highlight right there. Because it was awesome. It was just, like, it enwrapped you. Oh,
man. Yeah, that's the Hydra that you're referring to.
Ah, the Hydra.
Yeah, it's everybody's favorite part of that demo, because you sort of, you know, the demo, or, you know, the game is guiding you through sort of how to weaken the network, or, you know, sort of get a foothold, and then you use the Hydra, which spreads through the network and captures stuff that is that's unprotected, and then continues spreading. And so it's sort of like all of a sudden you've captured an enormous chunk of this network, you know, at relatively low cost. And that's always a good move. It's harder to do, of course, in, like, the really difficult levels to get into a position to use it. But it's always, like, it's the moment of payoff, essentially.
Yeah, you feel powerful. Like, it's like, oh, man, I own half of the board now.
Yeah.
Can't stop me. Because I went into the demo, like, oh, my goodness, there's a lot of nodes. There's no way I'm going to get, like, more than five of these before I'm like, oh, man, I've spent way too long here.
Yeah, and it's sort of actually meant to have this aesthetic of like too much of, you know, one of the terms that's used to define cyberspace was unthinkable complexity, and that was in Neuromancer, one of the, you know, the first cyberpunk books that, you know, kind of gave birth to this whole cyberpunk aesthetic. And so one thing that I tried to do in Darknet was have these relatively simple systems where once you understood them, you know, they were not going to be too daunting. But before you understood them, they looked just impossible. Like, it's just like there's hundreds of nodes in front of you. They're all, like, you know, passing data between each other, and some of them are different colors or have rings floating around them, and there's just so much of it. And inside any one of them, there's, like, several hundred, you know, hexes that all, you know, seem like they relate to each other in different ways, and you don't know how they work. And, you know, so kind of overloading the player at the beginning is important to me, because I guess it sort of, it ties in with what I think makes hackers cool in movies, which, you know, like, in a hacking movie, you'll see the character look at some, you know, ridiculous screen or whatever of just, like, you know, the code in the Matrix or something, where it's just, like, impossible to understand. It's just way too complex. You have no idea what it means, but that character understands it, and that's what makes them so cool. And so, you know, the difference between, like, a somebody who's never played Darknet, you know, they're the person who's watching and has no idea what's going on. Somebody who's gone through just, like, you know, a tutorial understands it and is that hacker now. Yeah.
Nice. the most ridiculous hacking scene that I've seen recently, it just came to me. Have you seen this movie? It was kickstarted. It's called Kung Fury.
Yes. Yes.
The hacking scene in that movie. Oh, man.
Yeah.
I
wasn't there, like, a guess the password scene or something like that?
I don't think so. He hacks the download to the upload and is able to transport the main character through time.
Right, yeah. They hack time.
Are you sure you want to hack time? Yes. that was just a weird tangent that came up. I was wondering if you had seen that, because I got a good laugh.
It's lampooning, like, the sort of the same things that, you know, the Darknet is taking inspiration from. You know, there's a lot of these movies that sort of follow those tropes of, you know, sort of, like, do we dare hack this thing? And then just a bunch of techno babble, and then something impossible happens. And I don't know. I kind of like that, and Darknet kind of follows that, not in sort of a funny, cheesy way, but in, like, I'm not too concerned about following the rules of real-world hacking. I'm not really interested in actual cybersecurity. I just like this idea of, like, you know, power in the computer, playing with that.
Yeah, real hacking doesn't look nearly as entertaining. It's like, oh, you wrote a line of code, now you're waiting 20 minutes? Nice.
Yeah, or, like, you know, you're calling up the receptionist, trying to trick them into giving you a password or something. I would much rather be flying through cyberspace in virtual reality.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, using my wits against the system.
Take that, firewalls.
Exactly.
So you said that it was complete in December. Have you made any changes to the game?
I have.
Since then?
Yes, the game. I'm planning on releasing a PC version for the Oculus Rift when that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've made some changes that are designed to take advantage of, you know, the extra performance that I'll have on PC as compared to, you know, a phone. But I've also gone and tried to make some gameplay changes, partially just to sort of expand the game and give it, some, you know, more shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
And then partially in response to some things that players have requested. So, like, in Darknet, you know, sort of in the vanilla version, there's a most of the pressure comes from the timer. You know, you're hacking this network, but mostly you're racing against the clock, and there's nothing sort of fighting back against you. And so one element that I've introduced into some of the networks in Darknet, in, you know, this updated version, which is not yet released, is these sort of enemy agents, where, you know, another hacker that's sort of acting defensively is working against you and, you know, recapturing nodes and strengthening the network in different ways. And you can sort of, you know, fight them off, you know, with different items and things like that.
So is that kind of more of a real-time thing, or is that turn-based, or how exactly does the time flow work with them hacking?
The game proceeds the same way it does in you know, Darknet as it is now, where, you know, the time is constantly ticking down, and you know, you're just trying to get to the root node, you know, before that time runs out. With the sort of enemy agent, you know, hacker that I'm talking about here, uh-huh. that's just taking place in the background. It's not like an actual other player. I decided to forego doing real multiplayer. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of a, you know, a semi-predictable object in the network that's sort of moving from node to node and going for the, you know, the nodes that you've hacked and then restoring them, you know, even stronger than they were before. And so it's sort of constantly happening in the background. And you need to be, you know, sort of keep that in mind. Like, it might engender certain strategies of like, oh, I'm going to go hack in this part of the network that's really far away from the rest to draw away the enemy. Ooh. So that I can go hack over here, you know, in this other part for longer without being disturbed.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's all taking place in, you know, in real time in that case. But, you know, while the timer's ticking down. But it's not like you're in, like, a synchronous direct combat with the thing.
I gotcha. Yeah, I was thinking that this entity would just, like, choose a spot and start working its way out, so you'd have to, like, go attack it. But the whole idea of it kind of following you around and you being able to trick it, oh, that's good. Because then not only are you hacking, but you feel like you're outsmarting the system. Right.
That's the goal. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Great. All right. So we've covered Darknet. We've talked a bit about VR. Have you used the Leap Motion?
Yes, I have. I did a couple small games for Leap Motion. Nothing with Leap in VR, though.
Or nothing with what?
Nothing with Leap Motion in VR.
Oh, okay.
Like, they've made a pretty big push to be able to like see your hands in VR and actually attach the Leap Motion to a VR headset. Mm-hmm. I have not played around with that as a developer yet.
Okay. Yeah, I got the Leap Motion. I joined into their jam last year. Yeah, it was last year. That was also through Indiecade. I played around with that a bit. I didn't really make anything interesting, but I learned how to use it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they it comes with a little clip for the Oculus, so you can just snap it right on there. That's really cool that they're doing that. That's probably what sold me on it, was being able to see my hands while I'm playing some virtual reality game. But yeah, what did you create with Leap Motion?
I made some non-VR stuff. One of them was a long time ago, and it was sort of like a simple strategy game prototype, not really worth talking about. More recently, I made a spellcasting game where it's not tracking your hands, it's only doing tool tracking, which is like a pencil or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's you know, the pencil represents like a wand in the game. And so it's sort of like Harry Potter spellcasting or something. We called it Swish and Flick. It's detecting gestures or, like, you know, sort of certain patterns of movement and translating those into spells. And you're sort of dueling against another wizard.
I'm looking it up quick.
Because barely been anything, you know. It wasn't like a published game or anything like that. It was made at a 2-day game jam.
Oh, okay. So it wouldn't be on their store?
No, it wasn't submitted to the store.
Okay. Because there was a spellcasting game that I saw there a while back. My friend was super pumped about it. And I was
While I was making it, I at one point went on the, you know, Leap website and I looked and I was like, oh, like everyone's had this idea. That said, this one does play pretty different from what I've seen so far.
Yeah, so. I believe the one that I saw, too, used hand gestures instead of a wand.
Yeah. And mine, you know, the wand is actually, it's not so much gestures as it is like a radial menu, where, like, you know, you'll have like sort of a circle of options, you know, it's like different directions that you're going to move your wand. So if you move it to the left, that sort of selects fire spells, and then that brings up a new set of options. It's also in sort of a radial menu on the same circle. And so by, you know, you'll sort of memorize, oh, this particular spell is, you know, a sequence of five moves. It's like, you know, left, up, you know, bottom, right, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you can memorize those movements. And it's nice because tracking, you know, hitting points on a radial menu is a lot easier than actually learning gestures. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty good about recognizing them.
Yeah, that was definitely the hardest part with using the leap motion, was kind of wrapping my head around how to, like, track gestures and movements, because it's like, well, how do you record it, and then how do you take that data and turn it into, you know, knowing that that's a gesture?
Right.
So, yeah, your radial thing is a clever solution to that. And that was just over a two-day little jam?
Yeah, and so the thought was that if it felt really good, then I could try to do it in virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even, you know, use something like the HTC Vive, you know, which has that's, you know, Valve's headset, and it uses two really well-tracked hand controllers. And so my problem with the Leap Motion is that it's kind of jittery. It doesn't, you know, it's not perfectly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
The Vive, on the other hand, is really accurate. And so I could imagine, you know, maybe making the spellcasting game in full on the Vive. But, you know, I have my plate full right now, so I sort of put that to the side.
Yeah, so when is the Vive coming out? It's 2016, right? Is there a release date?
they said 2015.
Oh, they did.
Yeah, they have not yet backed down from that. There's, you know, all sorts of speculation about, like, mid-December or thereabouts. And it's not clear, you know, how many will be available or how wide the release will be. But they are still, as far as I know, shooting for this year.
Okay. Yeah, there was a game at IndieCade. I think there might have been a game in the Firehouse, too. But it was a Job Simulator.
Oh yeah,
and that was using the tracking, and that was a huge line. I didn't even get a chance to play it. Every time I'd go there, there were like 5 to 10 people in line, and it's about 15-minute sessions. So I was like, oh, I'm not waiting in line for 2 hours.
Yeah, and the Vive has a a wider tracking area than the Oculus Rift. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's built for room scale, and it has the motion controllers, and it's gotten a lot of really really good testimonials, and so and then there's just not many of them out there, so every time it shows up in public, it's just mobbed. So many people want to try it. At this point, you know, they I think they sort of stepped up the number that they've sent out to developers recently, so that's good. Hopefully, you know, people will get to try it in the same way people got to try the Oculus Rift, just from having a friend who has it or something like that. But it's sort of the most in demand for public demos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe there were three, I don't even know what to call them, sensors that were put into the room. Do you know if that's going to be a thing in the final version? Or are you going to have to mm-hmm. have all three of those sensors?
I think it's just two.
Oh, and, just two.
Yeah, you're supposed to set them up on opposite corners of the room, like on the ceiling looking down or something like that. And they're actually shooting out lasers, and they're synced with each other, and you know, it's a very particular, like, you know, speed and everything. And the headset is actually reading them, and using, you know, it's reading them fast enough that it can use that information to, you know, figure out exactly where you are in space. So there's a lot of, you know, cool advantages to that system where, like, you know, the those, you know, base stations, they're called, or lighthouses that are shooting out these lasers, don't actually have to be connected to your computer at all. They can be pretty dumb and just, you know, just sit and do their thing. And then you can have any number of devices that are in the room, you know, reading those signals. So, like, you can actually just set up, you know, you need to set up two sensors to have, you know, one headset running. Mm-hmm. But then you could introduce a second and third and fourth headset without setting up any more sensors, and they should all run.
Really?
Yeah. There's been a couple people who've done that for demos, where they'll, you know, set up the two sensors and then like a row of like four different, you know, Vives, four different headsets.
That's really cool.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
So do you have a Vive then too?
I do. Yes.
You've got the whole collection.
I have like a dozen different headsets right now. Some of them are sort of outdated and I probably will not ever use again, but I'm just drowning in them. My Vive, unfortunately, I've had like a good long demo with one before I got mine, mm-hmm. but I struggled with some firmware problems on mine where one of the base stations wasn't working. So it would work perfectly as long as you only faced in one direction, which kind of defeats the purpose. I've been working on other stuff on trying to, you know, get the first version of Tactera done. So I haven't really spent much time, you know, troubleshooting that at this point. I do look forward to trying to make the game into a room scale version, though.
Absolutely. So you just brought up Tactera, or Tectura, as I was calling it earlier. So I think this is a good segue to jump into that. So
sure.
Now that you're like pretty much moving on from Dark Knight, you might still have a couple things left to do, but for the most part, you've moved on, and now you've brought on this project, which I haven't, tried yet. So I only know as much as the video shows. So you want to give us your pitch on what this game is?
Yes, Tactera is a virtual tabletop real-time strategy. So essentially, you have this holographic battlefield in miniature in front of you, and there's tanks rolling over the hills and planes flying overhead, and you're commanding these troops around the battlefield in sort of a real-time strategy gameplay. So think like a tabletop game, except all the pieces are moving. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, if you guys want to follow along and view the video or check out the screenshots, it is tacteragame.com. That's seven letters, T-A-C-T-E-R-A. So easy to spell, easy to remember. Check it out. There's a couple screenshots on there that mm-hmm. show gameplay. And then, of course, the video, which is, you know, 30 screenshots per second, pretty much. Definitely go check that out. So where'd you get the idea for this one?
I'm not really sure. Again, I'm sort of playing with tropes from sci-fi where, mm-hmm. you know, I knew there's this idea of, like, the command center, you know, in the near future where all the military people are gathered around this table that's projecting a hologram of whatever's happening and, you know, poking it in different ways to make stuff happen. So I built a little prototype for that for a hackathon, I guess maybe about a year ago.
Okay.
It was very simple. It was, you know, not very good. My tanks were composed out of stretched out cubes in Unity, which actually was fine. No one really noticed. Anyway, so I took that, and eventually Oculus announced they were doing another VR jam, the mobile VR jam, specifically for the Gear VR, and that took place early this year, in like, you know, March or April. And so I decided that I was going to take advantage of that again. So I, my schedule was clear, and used that as sort of the motivation or the, you know, hard deadline to get myself to build a prototype. And so that's how Tactera was born. And I did not win the jam this time around, but I had a finished product, and people seemed to like it, and Oculus seemed to like it, so I decided that that would be my next thing. So that's what I'm working on right now. The plan right now is to finish a free demo version that I can release relatively soon, after the Gear VR consumer launch, so probably like mid-December, okay. And then follow that up early next year with a full version.
Wow, that's pretty fast turnaround.
Yeah, well, I it could be that way, but you could also see it as like I've been working on it for, you know, 6 or 7 months or so, and frankly, I feel like I'm behind schedule. Like I should have had all this stuff done. You know, I worked too slowly in those intervening months. Only now am I really sort of getting to like a really good pace of productivity. Huh. It's hard being a one person studio. Mm-hmm. Like if you have like a slow day, then your entire studio has had a slow day.
You know? That's why I'm like that is a fast turnaround, because usually like 2, 3, 4 people studios take more than a year to ship a game. So
that's true, and you know that partially reflects the scope of the game. And I should also be clear that although I keep saying I'm a one person studio, I get help from independent contractors for the stuff that I can't do myself, like art or music or sound or things like that. So I do all the programming and game design and PR and production and all of that, but it's actually like 6 or 7 people who have their hands on any one of my games.
You know, that's an interesting topic to bring up. I was recently introduced to this website called Skindler, Skindler, and they are basically a new firm that is for contracting freelance game developers and artists and musicians and modelers and you name it for games. Hmm. It's really cool. They want to kind of be like the place to go to if you need people to work on your game. But right now, obviously, you have to go out and kind of do it yourself. You have to find people. How do you find people that are reliable and that fit your project? How do you find these contractors that you work with?
It's a couple different ways. Some people are local, and I've met them and gotten to talk to them or take a look at their projects and things like that. Others I find through Twitter or just online. Other developers will send out an email saying, "Oh, I worked with so and so. They're great. They're looking for work." And it's sometimes just a happy coincidence. Like, oh, that's exactly what I need right now. So, for example, for the UI art on Darknet, I saw a tweet from a guy named Clemens Scott, who was an artist, who'd done work on some games that I just thought were absolutely gorgeous. And they were 2D games, they were really stylized, and they looked like nothing else I'd ever seen, and I thought they looked great. And those games were Chasing Aurora and Secrets of Radicon by the studio Broken Rules.
Okay.
And so, I followed him on Twitter. He mentioned he needed work. I contacted him. He did just amazing work right off the bat for Darknet. And it was one of those things where, it's like just getting a present in your inbox, every couple days of just more amazing art that I didn't even know that's what I wanted, but it's perfect. And so for Tactera, I worked with him again because I had such a good experience. And then also I needed help on some 3D models because I was doing little tanks and fighters and stuff like that. And so he, it turns out, had a colleague who was a 3D modeler and in his off time worked on Papercraft, actually. So to me that seemed like the perfect, hobby for a low-poly 3D artist. And so I contacted him and, he came with a recommendation from someone I really trusted and liked. And that worked out perfectly as well. In other cases where I don't have as much confidence in, a person's previous work or something like that, I'll try to do some sort of like limited, first try and just see how well we work together, mm-hmm. Some like subtask or something. It's mostly worked out, I think mostly if you look at a person's previous work, that gives you a decent idea of the quality of what they can do in the future.
Oh, absolutely. So you haven't had to like shut anyone down? Sorry, you're not the fit.
I have a couple times. I've never done that. It's always been like some sort of paid job. Like I'll hire someone to do, a small amount of work, and then if I'm not thrilled with it, then I'll just sort of move on. That's only happened a couple times, actually. And, you know, some of that was like when I was just starting out and I didn't really know how to find anyone or things like that. That actually, I had to do that the most when I was just looking up for freelancers on the internet. And, I, you know, I go to sites where it's like, here's where people look for freelancers. And for some reason, that didn't get me a really great, you know, set of options.
Mm-hmm.
And it was once I started looking through people, you know, whose work I really liked or other developers that I trusted, you know, and doing sort of networking, that I was able to find people that I, you know, really did good results.
Hmm. Sweet. Yeah, the freelancing sites are very hit or miss.
Like, and I should be clear, like, I haven't tried, like, Skindler or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It was mostly, like, forums or, like, different subreddits for people looking for game work and stuff like that.
Okay.
More like, you know, free association things.
Mm-hmm. So did you use anything like Freelancer or Elance or anything like that? Or did you mostly stick with, like, the subreddits and forums?
I looked into Freelancer and Elance, and there were things, you know, that I liked about it, but I also just sort of, I don't know. You'd find people, you know, who are, you know, you need programming help, and you find someone who says, oh, I can do programming. I can take care of your, you know, full stack server programming needs. And it becomes pretty clear that they're talking to some, you know, a different studio than mine. They're talking to, like, a, you know, a startup or something like that. So then I'll find a Unity programmer and I'll, like, oh, perfect. They're doing Unity. They're doing 2D work. That's what I'm looking for. But then all of their work is for mobile, free-to-play, casual games. And, you know, it's all of the same style or something like that. And it's clear, like, they are fulfilling a need. You know, mm-hmm. there's a niche that they have found for themselves, and they're advertising their services on Elance, and people who need that kind of thing find them there. But I just always had the impression that it was, you know, this is not where anybody went to work on indie games.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, that's sort of limited. Like, I'm sure that there are some of these people would be happy to work on, you know, an indie game and would be capable of it. I just didn't feel like I had the right kind of confidence to sort of start that process.
Okay, that makes sense.
I hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had mixed experience. I've been on the other side of those sites.
Mm-hmm.
And they're weird. I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
It's hard to find, like, the perfect match, because it's just, like, all these people being thrown into this pit, like, crying, like, hey, hire me, and it's like, hey, I'm looking for a programmer, somebody, and everybody's just yelling into the void and hoping that they run into each other.
Yeah, that's also part of it, you know, from the perspective of somebody who's looking for work, or, you know, who's looking to hire someone, you might say, like, if you put up an ad saying, I need somebody who can do this specific thing, you'll no matter what it is, you'll get 100 people saying, I can do that exact thing perfectly. I've done it a billion times before. Hire me right now. And many of them, I think, you know, that's copy-pasted. They're not really, like, looking for a perfect match.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's hard.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I'm sure it's a skill that a lot of people are trying to master, is being able to find people to work on their project that are good and fit with the project. So we're pretty much at the 60-minute mark. We can still go a bit more if you're okay with time.
Yeah, I have nothing going on. Happy to talk.
Okay, sweet. Yeah, I just didn't want to, like, be like, oh, yeah, we're going to keep going, but...
Yeah, no worries.
If you have stuff, too bad. No. Let's jump into the past. So, before you got into VR, I guess I have two questions. That was the second question. One, VR...
Time travel, man.
What?
I said time travel. It always messes you up.
Yeah, exactly. The first one is, did you ever see yourself getting into VR? Is this anything that you could have predicted?
Not really. I knew I wanted to be a game developer for a long time. I thought for a while that I wanted to be a game programmer. And then over the course of college, I slowly realized that I didn't really like programming. I just did it because it allowed me to do game design. And then I thought I was going to be in the AAA industry for a long time. And so I tried to follow that path. And then I sort of realized that I had the opportunity to go indie. So I did. And then I didn't really think I was going to do anything in VR. Like, that wasn't something that I was setting out to do. I just backed the Kickstarter for Oculus because it had such great testimonials from, like, you know, Cliff Bleszinski and mm-hmm. Gabe Newell and John Carmack and all these people I trusted. So I kind of stumbled into VR. And, you know, not everybody who's working in VR followed that path. Like, I think there's a good number of people who are, you know, VR developers first and foremost, and they are super into virtual reality. That's what they want to work in. Whereas I am a game developer first and foremost. You know, games are what fascinates me, and I happen to be working in the medium of VR. If it turns out that, like, VR is a complete flop, or if it turns out that no one really wants to play games in VR, they just want to, like, watch movies or do passive experiences, mm-hmm. that's totally fine. I'll just move back to doing games and other media. You know, it would be sort of a shame, but it's not like I would, I don't know, would keep plugging away at it, because the part that interests me is the games, not so much the VR.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah, I've thought about that. Is VR... I mean, everybody has thought of it. Like, is VR going to take off? And I mm-hmm. think... this could turn into a bit of a tangent. I think we might have brought it up on the radio before, actually. I think the rebirth of arcades in America could definitely happen from VR. Mm-hmm. Because you need space... you need all this hardware. You need money for the hardware, and people to have all of those. You know, it's not a possibility for everyone. Like, some people mm-hmm. like can't afford the hardware, and other people they're like, oh, we can't clear a room in our house. No way. So I think arcades, like, if somebody can create a chain of arcades. That does VR stuff, I think that would probably be the biggest push to making mm-hmm. VR, like, stick around for a while. Even if it doesn't necessarily take off in homes, like, it would still be able to exist.
Yeah, I sort of see a continuum of, like, quality and cost, where on sort of the bottom you have Google Cardboard, which is really, really low cost, very convenient, but just not good in terms of quality. Pretty far beyond that, you have something like the Gear VR, which is, you know, still relatively, you know, convenient and cheap, but good. Then you have, like, PlayStation VR and Oculus Rift and the HTC Vive, which are, like, you have to set everything up yourself and, you know, have the special equipment, but it's really good. And then the step beyond that would be what you're talking about, which is, like, the, you know, out-of-home entertainment arcade model. And there is a couple companies that are doing really interesting things in that. One of them is actually called VRcade. There's another company called The Void, which you may have heard of it. What they're doing is, like, building, like, a purpose-built structure that's just like an environment for playing VR games in. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, they're doing interesting things with that, where, like, you know, there'll be like a panel on the wall that it's actually just like a flat painted, you know, square. But in virtual reality, it looks like some futuristic, you know, touch screen or whatever, and you can interact with it. Or they'll have like a giant loop of, you know, around the building. And as you walk along it, they adjust the direction that you're seeing so that it feels like you're walking along a straight hallway infinitely mm-hmm. and that you're not locked in just like this warehouse. And these are real things that they're working on and doing and feel really cool to me. So I think that experience might be, you know, not so much analogous to going to an arcade as like going paintballing or something, where you go, you probably pay a little more money, you spend more time in there, they have to like set you up and give you the equipment and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still like something that people would want to do. It's still really cool.
Yeah, setup is a huge part of that too. Like, who wants to set up and take down, you know, a crazy Vive setup, you know, put your cameras up, you know, boot it up to your computer, get everybody set up. But if you went to a place like that, that would be like one of the best parts right there, is that they already have it set up, it runs, you don't need to adjust anything, you just slip it on and go. And then the thing about walking in a straight line, I did hear something about that, how you can like have a circular room and they can adjust the image in there to make you walk in circles infinitely. Yeah. But it feels like you're just walking in a straight line, and that is the coolest
thing. Redirected
thing.
Walking is the term to Google there.
Redirected and, walking, okay.
Yeah, and it's like the way I think about it is like, if you have you ever tried closing your eyes and walking in a perfectly straight line, and then you open your eyes and you realize that you're off by like at least a few degrees. You know, sort of drifted off to the side. We're not really good at telling just through our bodies what, you know, a straight direction is. And so what these, you know, what this technology is doing is it's just sort of, as you move forward, it's rotating your view, your camera, in just the right way so that, you know, as you're sort of correcting it, you're actually going along a circle.
Yeah, I think I've done it with my eyes closed, but I definitely know at night when all the lights are off, I'll like try finding the door, and I'll find that I'm hitting the opposite side of the door, and it's like, oh my gosh, where is this hammer? So yeah, you can almost sometimes even feel it. You're like, oh, I'm not walking in a straight line, crap.
Yeah, I'm just guessing at this point.
I'm not 100% sure
that the sort of stand up and walk around experiences are going to be the most common use case for VR. Like, I think it is possible that something like the Oculus Rift, you know, where it's more like you're at your desk moving around in VR, I think that might be sort of a nice sweet spot of like ease of setup and cost and, you know, comfort of, you know, of using this experience like that. If I was going to use it for, you know, an hour or two or more, I feel like I'd probably want to be doing it in my comfy office chair.
Mm-hmm.
So different use cases, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So arcades, we drifted. Okay, and then so I asked you, you know, did you think you're gonna be into VR? And then the other question that goes hand in hand with it was, what were you working on before VR? What kind of stuff were you doing?
So I'll go two steps back. Immediately before I did VR, I actually worked on a game for the Ouya. Do you remember the Ouya?
Oh yeah, I've got mine just a few feet away from me, actually.
Yeah, I have one of the like special developer Kickstarter editions.
Ooh.
Because so apparently, you know, my thing is kickstarting new hardware and trying to get in at the ground floor. So I made a simple like same screen multiplayer like abstract sports game called Bomb Ball. For Ouya, and that was a launch title, and that was fun. I'm very proud of the game. It's there's a PC version available on my website, but Ouya did not really succeed as a console, and so that didn't really do anything for me from a business perspective. It did get played by Game Grumps on YouTube, though, so that was
really
cool. Before that, I actually, before I went indie, actually, when I was still in college, I just as like a side project, as like one of my hobbyist games, I built a game called Oralux, which is like a really slow real-time strategy game. It was meant to be more strategic, less about, you know, APM or reaction time. Very like kind of floaty and cerebral.
Mm-hmm.
And so I built that game, and I posted it temporarily for free on Reddit, and it hit the top of Reddit. And that got me enough attention that a company approached me wanting to port the game to mobile. And so I did that with them. And Aurelux got released on mobile on, you know, iOS and Android, and did really, really well there. It never really did that great on PC, which is where I built it. But the ported version did great. And that's, to a large extent, what allowed me to go indie in the first place. And actually, I am working with that company that did the original mobile port on doing a sequel to Aurelux, which I announced like a few days ago. So I don't often mention it in like the same conversation as I'm talking about my VR stuff, because it feels so separate.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm actually like releasing three games in like the same, you know, same window. Darknet Tactera and Aurelux Constellations.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yeah. On that one, you know, I'm not doing any of the programming work, really.
Mm-hmm.
But I am responsible for doing all of the level design and things like that, and, you know, some of the game design. So it's, I'm sort of like quarter time on Aurelux.
Okay.
And yeah, looking forward to that coming out probably around the turn of the year.
So with all these releases, are you feeling a bit stressed? Is releasing a VR game more or less stressful than a normal game?
It is maybe less stressful, just because right now there's not much of a market. So if you release on Steam, you know, you have like a giant surge of like a million people viewing it at once, mm-hmm. and you have to really knock it out of the park at the beginning. With VR, I released Darknet last year in December, and there were not many people who had a Gear VR at the time. So it turned out like it was a pretty successful launch. Like, there wasn't anything horribly wrong with it, and the, you know, Oculus probably would not have allowed it to launch if there was. But if I had like screwed up somehow, it wouldn't have been that big a deal, you know, because like, it's sort of a slow rollout of the technology, of the, you know, a slow increase in the audience. Mm-hmm. That's going to be, you know, less and less true now, though. Now that the Gear VR consumer launch is happening, the Oculus Rift launch is happening. I think those launches, you know, from a software perspective, might be more stressful than before.
I gotcha.
Yeah, just more writing on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then with Bombball, or no, not Bombball, sorry, the sequel,
Aurelux,
there we go. It's like Octera, no, Aurelux. So many names.
I'm giving you a lot of names to think about.
So the Aurelux, you said you were just doing the level, wait, no, it wasn't.
Yeah, level design.
Okay, it was level design, okay.
Yeah.
And so with that, I'm guessing they're probably taking care of most of the, like, publishing and getting it out there.
Yeah, the majority. I'm helping out, you know, I'm like sort of writing about the game, like doing blog posts and things like that, you know, helping talk about the game. Mm-hmm. They're doing a lot of the work with, you know, talking to publishers and things like that, or, you know, the platforms. So I'm really grateful for that. We're actually targeting not just mobile, but also, you know, PC and console releases as well.
Ooh.
So,
are you able to talk about which consoles, or do you guys even know yet?
We have a decent idea, but are not doing like a real announcement yet. So I'll hold on to that.
Okay. Yeah. No problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm always looking for new Vita games to.
Oh yeah.
To load up my Vita. There are so many great indie titles on there, and that's pretty mm-hmm. much what my memory card is full of. I really need to get a second memory card to hold more stuff, but I haven't quite gotten around to it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, which consoles do you have?
Almost none.
Almost none.
I mean, like, I have a PS3 and an Xbox 360,
mm-hmm.
but mostly I have a nice PC, and that's where I do, you know, almost all of my stuff. You know, I haven't really felt impaired by that at all. Like, almost all of the games that I've wanted to play have been available on PC.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm on the verge of finally getting one of the next-gen consoles or current-gen consoles. maybe just because of Rock Band 4. But there have been one or two other things I remember that are pushing me in that direction. But I have not yet taken the plunge.
Yeah, I'm really surprised that I haven't been all over Rock Band. I suppose it's because I haven't played the new version yet. Guitar Hero was like middle school age for me. So I'd come home every day and play it for like 3 hours. Like my friends were all like, "Holy crap, how are you so good at this?"
I've never enjoyed the guitar on any of these games.
Oh, really?
But I love singing, and I really got into Rock Band drumming. Once that happened, I was all over it. And it was great, because there were so many people who already knew the guitar.
Yeah, so you were able to complete their band.
Exactly. They were able to complete my band.
Oh, man. Yeah, the whole Rock Band thing brings back a lot of memories of me and my buds just jamming out, swapping between, so...
Yeah, like, the Rock Band 4 would almost be, like, a nostalgia purchase for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I was always more of a Guitar Hero guy. I had, like, the Guitar Hero drum set with the cymbals and
all
that stuff. But that was mostly just me being a middle school-aged kid that was like, oh, Guitar Hero is so much better than Rock Band just because it is, you know?
Yeah.
They happened first.
I don't know. They were both made by Harmonix, so...
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah, pretty much. So I'll probably succumb. Well, no, that's not the right word. I'll probably just get Rock Band when I have a next gen console as well, because it's so much fun. So have you ever worked on any like party games? It looked like Bomb Ball was multiplayer.
Yeah, it's it is designed for like being good in a crowded setting. It's one of the big things I focused on with Bomb Ball was designing for spectators.
Okay.
So there's different things about it that are designed to be like, you know, fun to watch as well as play, and easy to watch. So, I actually kind of want to, you know, enough time has passed, I want to go back to that game and make a few changes and like make a 4-player mode and simplify some of the, you know, special mechanics and things like that. But the base game I think works really well. One of my favorite experiences with it actually was playing at IndieCade when Ouya had a tent in 2013, I think. I was there with Bomb Ball and did like a little tournament where the winner would get an Ouya. And so it went all the way, you know, down to finals, and there was a really good final match. And then after the guy got his prize, there was like a show match between that winner and me, the developer, which was the best. It was tied for most of the game, but then I pulled away and won like 5-2. So all is right with the universe.
Perfect. Oh, that's so cool. I remember there being a tent in 2014. I didn't go to IndieCade 2013, but yeah, the Ouya tent was really cool. They had couches in there and it was a nice little tent.
I missed 2014, which I'm really sad about. But they had the right idea. Like, the Ouya, I really like the idea of it's a cheap console for doing, you know, like same-screen multiplayer stuff. Or, like, you know, these fun, simple games that, you don't need a whole lot of power to enjoy playing against somebody else on the couch with you.
Mm-mm.
And there are actually a lot of good games for that. That fit that, you know, same screen multiplayer niche.
Yeah, the games that I would always play were Toto Temple Deluxe, Towerfall. Because I mean, if you have an Ouya, you gotta get Towerfall. Duck Game, and my entire list was party games.
Yeah,
and like
Hidden
that
in Plain Sight was a big one for me.
Which one?
Hidden in Plain Sight.
Oh yeah, that is so much fun.
Right. And for those who don't know what that is, it's like a game where there's like a, you know, 50 characters on the screen and, you know, 4 players, each of whom is controlling one of these characters. And so a lot of the game is trying to figure out by their behavior who's an actual real life player and not just like an AI. So it's like trying to trick each other and trying to, like, you know, hide in plain sight, as the title says.
Yeah, and at the beginning of each match, you don't know who you are either, so you have to try to like subtly do movements without making it obvious to the other players that that's you as well. So it's a total mind game, and I think that's where all the fun stems from, because you try to trick your friends into thinking that you're not that guy and that maybe you're that character, or yeah, and there's like 5 different modes.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different sort of games within the game, of ways of exploring this mechanic.
Yeah, that was really well. I don't even know who made that.
I would recognize the name if I saw it. You know, at one point I'd be able to mention it. But yeah, that's, you know, just another game that's like, it didn't need a ton of power. It doesn't need to run on a PS3. It's perfect for, you know, gathering around the couch and playing. Like, it was a great Ouya game. And so it's yeah, you know, I liked Ouya. I feel like there's a lot of people who, you know, kind of wrote it off from the very beginning, and that hurt it in sort of public perception, and that wasn't entirely fair. You know, I wish that it was stuck around, was more of a success.
Mm-hmm. Jumping back to the name, it's Adam's Sprague or Sprague.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, no, the Ouya collapsing in on itself was super, super awful. They were recently acquired by Razer.
Yeah,
I believe. But I haven't really looked into that. Like I got an email a while back saying like what's happening, but I didn't really read into it. So it'll be interesting to see if they do anything with Ouya, like creating a new console, or if they just are putting the resources from Ouya into what they're working on.
Yeah, I think a big part of it is probably going to be taking the Ouya store and, you know, sharing that in China or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's their software library that's considered the most valuable part of Ouya at this point.
Oh, definitely, yeah. The I mean, the console was great. The controller was, it was all right. But you could, of course, hook up any kind of controller to it, pretty much. But yeah, the software library there is really, really great. And I think part of that too was that it just runs on Android, so like it's super accessible to everybody. You didn't have to like learn some entirely new world of programming like you would with VR or working for a bigger console. So
VR is not actually that bad,
is it?
You'd be surprised. Yeah. I mean, it's compatible with Unity and Unreal, the biggest, you know, engines. And they've actually made it really easy in Unity. You know, right now, you just have to check a box that says VR supported. And then your main camera turns into a VR camera. So, you know, there's design things you need to account for, like, you know, properly displaying the depth of objects and not making the player sick and things like that. From a technical perspective, they've made it pretty easy. What I tend to tell people is making a good game is way, way harder than making something work in VR.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the VR part is not the hard part. It's making anything worth experiencing, worth spending time on.
Yeah, I've heard that from a couple game developers. Not on VR, but just in games in general. Like, anybody can make a game, and that's totally true, but to make a good, polished game, that's where the challenge is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's universal. VR, Ouya, games. Alright,
yeah.
So we are nearing an hour and a half, so I think we probably should wrap it up.
Okay.
This has been a great talk. Is there anything else that you'd like to bring up before we come to a close?
No, I guess, you know, to plug my stuff, if you go to emcneill.com, emcneill.com, that has links to all of the games that I've talked about. Aurelux, Bomb Ball, Darknet, Tectera. So if you're curious about any of those, you'll see them in a big list there. Yeah, that'll be it.
Yeah, that was our next part. We usually let people plug. And your Twitter is E_McNeil?
Yes.
Yes. Perfect. So yeah, follow E, check out his website, all that stuff. If you are listening to this in the archive version, there will be links on the site under click to show topics, or maybe it's just show topics, click here. I don't remember what the text is. That was like a year ago that I wrote that. You can click on that, look at these show topics, and it'll have links to all the relevant topics that we discussed today, including E's site, Twitter, all that stuff. And yeah, thanks so much for coming on. If you want to stick around for a minute after the show, we can talk for a minute. And
sure,
yeah,
this was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for coming on. All right, so now it is time for the credits.
Thank you for listening in to broadcast number 68 of Indie Radio.
Indie Radio is broadcasted live with 1,000 mics and recorded using Audacity. If you enjoy the show and are interested in more, you can visit our archive at indiefunction.com, SoundCloud,
or our recently added iTunes podcast.
So our next show will be on November 21st with Handmade Heroes' Casey Muratori. Super excited for that. We're going to talk to him about Handmade Con that's coming up, and the one-year anniversary of Handmade Hero is also happening the same week as our interview, which is why we had him on that date. So we'll be talking about that, and then we were thinking about doing a December 5th show, but if I end up going out to Handmade Con, that show will be canceled, and we don't know who's going to be on that date. For sure, we have two developers that might jump on, but if it doesn't happen, then obviously we're not going to have either on. Anyway, thank you again for listening to Indie Radio, and we hope you have a fantastic weekend.